While I would need help from the Democratic establishment to win in November, I had my own plan for becoming the DFL nominee. With or without Harry and Chuck on board, it was full speed ahead. Minnesota's primary was scheduled for September 2008, but traditionally the nomination is won when a candidate is endorsed at the DFL state convention, which was scheduled for June 2008 in Rochester. The endorsement process was set to begin on February 5th, 2008, at local precinct caucuses, where DFLers would meet in their neighborhoods and choose delegates to move on to their Senate district or county conventions. At those regional conventions, delegates to the state convention would be elected, and in Rochester, those state convention delegates would join superdelegates, mostly state legislators and party officials, in voting on which candidate to endorse. If you got 60% of the state convention delegates, you got the party's endorsement, effectively becoming the nominee. Because I announced so early, February 14, 2007, we had nearly a full year before caucus night to get ready. What was our plan? Simple. Do everything we could to appeal to the people who were likely to show up on caucus night and participate in the complicated multi-step delegation selection process, the Beanfeed regulars I've been getting to know since returning to the state. Meanwhile, develop relationships with superdelegates and compete for the support of unions, environmental organizations, progressive advocacy groups, and other groups whose endorsement carried a lot of weight for party members who were likely to be politically active. Now, if all of this seems a little dry to you, imagine instead the training montage from a Rocky movie with a driving soundtrack and energetic editing. But instead of jumping rope, I'm eating hot dish at an assisted living facility that traditionally has high caucus turnout. Instead of guzzling a dozen raw eggs, I'm being driven 5 hours to speak for 5 minutes at the Otter Tail County Convention. Instead of hitting a speed bag, I'm playing phone tag with a state representative who's on the fence. Exciting. The grizzled veteran in charge of our field and outreach operation, my Burgess Meredith, if you will, was 25-year-old James Hager. James had worked on Paul Wellstone's last race in 2002, and like many young and not-so-young people who had poured their hearts and souls into that tragic campaign, he was initially hesitant about joining mine. I mentioned earlier that Paul's life and the tragic circumstances of his death and the ugly political aftermath made every step in my political journey feel a little heavier. And I was just Paul's friend. The entire Minnesota DFL community was full of people who had been at headquarters that October day when the call came, who had worked side by side with Mary McAvoy and Tom Lapek and Will McLaughlin, the staffers who had died in the crash, whose entire political consciousness had been shaped by the work they did for and with Paul and Sheila Wellstone. And for them, it's impossible to overstate just how much Paul's memory hung over our 2008 campaign. So when you tried to hire those people, you weren't just asking them to help you. You were asking them to trust you, to live up to Paul's legacy, and to carry on his work, and frankly, to avenge him a little bit. And that's a lot of trust to ask for, especially if you're the kind of candidate who is prone to, say, yelling at a prominent political reporter about the use of the word motherfuckers. It took a few weeks to convince James to come aboard. But when he did, he worked like a guy who had a lot more at stake than just his win-loss record. He put in 18 or 20-hour days, 7 days a week, plowing through the pile of cheap candy that was always on his desk and staring up at a whiteboard that listed which way all the key players in the state were leaning. Key players like Tom Rukavina, the hilarious and irascible curmudgeon who represented a big slice of the Iron Range in the state legislature. Story about Tom. He was once in a parade, and a guy he knew called out, "Hey, Tommy, why do you only care about the poor?" Without missing a beat, Rukavina responded, "You are poor, dummy." I may have been focused on the kind of patient grassroots organizing and relationship building I would need to win the DFL endorsement, but I wasn't ignorant of the extremely valid concerns that Chuck had raised about my chances in the general election. Early on, we hired a pollster, Diane Feldman, another Wellstone veteran, whose job it was to help me figure out the right way to talk to the broader audience of Minnesotans about who I was and what I wanted to do as their senator. We also needed another media consultant since Mandy was still tied up with Hillary, who was still battling Obama for the presidential nomination. After a few meetings, we hired Saul Shore, a garrulous bulldog of an ad man from Philadelphia, who was almost more excited than I was about going after Norm Coleman. With the team in place, it was time to get some data. The first internal polls we took roughly matched the public polling at the time. I was down by double digits against Coleman. As we convened our focus groups in the summer of 2007, our goal was to figure out how to get around the fact that I had an awful lot of edgy, dark, or off-color jokes on the record. Republicans had continued to process joke after joke through the dehumorizer, blasting each one out in irritating press release after irritating press release. The question was, how could we fix this? At the focus groups, Diane handed people a packet of information about me and asked them to underline the stuff that stood out to them. At one session in suburban Edina, she prodded a bit at the part about my using foul language to attack Republicans, rereading that section aloud. Franken has a history of using inappropriate language, including the F word, and launching personal attacks against public figures, including many sitting members of the U.S. Senate. For example, he once said that Republican politicians are shameless dicks. At that, a woman sat up in her chair. Oh! Diane pounced. Is it the F word or... There are a few uncomfortable laughs. I read what was here, said the woman, turning red, but I thought it was shameless ducks. The focus groups were helpful in determining a strategy for handling what, from then on, was inevitably referred to around our office as the Shameless Ducks Dossier. The results were actually pretty surprising. A few of the folks understood that I had been using the language for satiric effect, but in general, they were not terribly impressed that I had spent my entire adult life writing stuff like that. They didn't think the fact that I had been a successful comedian meant that I was intelligent. So it turned out that telling people I went to Harvard was a good thing, because it reassured them that despite having no experience in politics and having called some people some bad names, I was probably at least smart enough to handle government work. It was the first recorded instance of it being a good idea to tell people you went to Harvard. The books, it turned out, were also a good thing. People liked that I had written books because it showed that I had several books worth of serious thoughts about public policy in my brain, or at least that I had the work ethic to finish writing several books. Basically, the results we got from the focus groups were Harvard and books good, comedy bad. This called for a slight change in strategy. For example, Dusty had tracked down a pallet of kazoos somewhere, and when Team Franken did parades around the state, we had our supporters march, playing Ring of Fire and other hits on kazoos. We had fun, but after the focus groups, the consultants made it clear, get rid of the kazoos, unless we could find some kazoos with the Harvard logo on them. Dusty said he'd look into that. As summer turned to fall, I had company on the campaign trail. Back in April, Mike Cerisi had announced his candidacy. Mike was a successful trial lawyer who had represented the state of Minnesota in the big lawsuit against the tobacco industry, famously pressing the case until the tobacco companies released damaging internal documents and in the end securing a $6 billion settlement. So Mike was well-known and also rich and a serious candidate. My main rival for the DFL endorsement. But not my only rival. Jack Nelson Pallmeyer was a professor of peace studies at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. Tall, white-haired, and distinguished in that cardigan sweater, corduroy sport coat kind of way, Jack's campaign was built upon three clear issues: peace, the moral urgency of addressing climate change, and single-payer health care. I was for all those things in principle, but felt that some of his specific proposals, for example, a 50% cut in the Defense Department budget, were not just unrealistic, but irresponsible. Then there was Jim Cohn, an effusively friendly gadfly, who had once run unsuccessfully for the U.S. House in Connecticut. We'd show up at events, and he'd proclaim, "You don't have to be rich," talking about Mike, "or famous," talking about me, "to run for the Senate." The crowd agreed, but were also a bit confused about what, having stated what he wasn't, Jim did bring to the race. The four of us found ourselves all showing up at the same events, my blue and yellow signs competing for a space with Mike's yellow and red gear, Jack's green, and Jim's none. Meanwhile, I continued to update Chuck Schumer on our campaign's momentum. We were raising a ton of money, we were rolling up endorsements left and right, and we were taking it to Coleman as best we could. Chuck was happy to hear that things were going well, but still not particularly interested in getting behind me. But over the summer, we'd followed some advice, really a command from the DSCC, and conducted another poll to test our theory that the Shameless Ducks dossier was survivable. The results came in, and when we saw them, we breathed a sigh of relief. Armed with our poll, we scheduled another trip to Washington to sit down with Reid and Schumer and make our case. At the meeting, we carefully explained that while Minnesotans did have concerns about my history of questionable humor, we had found a response that worked. Reid interrupted, "What kind of jokes are we talking about?" We all looked at each other, not sure what to say. Reid tried again, looking at his notes. "It says here, Franken made jokes about the Holocaust. What does that mean?" Diane Feldman handed our poll to Harry and pointed to the joke we had tested. "I think a bad Hanukkah gift for Anne Frank would have been a drum set." I watched Harry closely as he read the joke and then burst out laughing. In fact, he started shaking with laughter. It was a surreal moment, sitting nervously with my consultants, watching Harry Reid convulse in hysterics over the idea of Anne Frank playing drums in the attic. Finally, he turned to me. I just shrugged. Now, oddly, it wasn't even my joke. It came from original SNL writer Rosie Schuster, and it found its way into a piece that I got credit for. Chapter 14, Icarus Soars. That fall, I got a letter from my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Moline. It started this way. "Dear Mr. Franken, if you're the Alan Franken who I taught in the fourth grade at Cedar Manor, then it doesn't surprise me that you're running for the Senate, because you are a very good student." This isn't my way of telling you that I was a very good student in the fourth grade, though I was. It's my way of telling you about my first campaign commercial. But seriously, I was a very, very good student in the fourth grade. Anyway, I looked Mrs. Moline up in the phone book and gave her a call. "You remember me?" she asked. "Oh, yes, Mrs. Moline, of course. I remember all my teachers at Cedar Manor." Then I went through my elementary school teachers, working backward. I loved Mr. Knutson, my sixth grade teacher, and Mrs. Longabaugh, my fifth grade teacher. I told Mrs. Moline that she was my favorite because she was. Then I told her I didn't much like my third grade teacher, whom I will not name here. "Well, she wasn't very nurturing," Mrs. Moline conceded in her adorable 74-year-old Minnesota accent. I invited Mrs. Moline to a campaign event at a house not far from hers. She came, and I instantly remembered why she had been my favorite. Mrs. Moline, still a small package, is a fireball of positive energy. I did the math, and I realized that she had been 27 when she taught me to do the math. When I told her that in fourth grade I thought she was kind of middle-aged, she laughed and gave me a little tweak on the cheek. When you're a kid, you don't usually learn very much about your teachers. Mrs. Moline was one of 17 children. 17. She and her husband, Dean, didn't have kids themselves, but over 34 years of teaching, she poured her energy and love into her students. I ran the idea of Mrs. Moline doing my first ad by my media consultants, Mandy and Saul. I sometimes joke that between me and Norm Coleman, who grew up in Brooklyn and sounded like it, I was the only New York Jew in the race who had actually grown up in Minnesota. What better way to establish my roots than to feature my lovable spitfire of a fourth-grade teacher? Mrs. Moline said, "Okay, Alan," and we were all set to go. Mandy was with Hillary working on ads for the battle with Obama that would last almost all the way to the convention. So Saul, whose best work generally involved ripping some deserving Republican a new belly button, produced an adorable ad featuring Mrs. Moline. It was a back and forth, Mrs. Moline in the classroom, me at campaign headquarters. So I read about this man running for U.S. Senate, and I thought, that's the Alan Franken I taught in St. Louis Park. I got this letter from Mrs. Moline. She wanted to help with the campaign, so I asked her to be in a TV ad. A TV ad? Mrs. Moline offered the camera a perfect look of surprise. But she was immediately game, saying with a swing of her arm, okay, here we go. Then Mrs. Moline gave my bio, accompanied by photos from my life. A nerdy, gap-toothed fourth grader, getting my diploma at, that's right, she dropped the H-bomb, Harvard. He was funny, too, she said. We cut to a photo of me with the SNL cast. I guess that's why he became a comedian. I was really more of a satirist, I protested, still at headquarters. Okay, Alan, she said as if to a nine-year-old. Mrs. Moline went on to say that I had written six books over a stunning shot of the six books piled on top of each other. Then to a video of me and Franny cooking in our kitchen. He's been married to Franny for 32 years, and they have two grown kids. Cut to a photo of Thomason and Joe looking like two nice, clean-cut human beings who share Franny's and my gene pool. And you know, he's visited our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan four times over pictures of me entertaining the troops. Then the reasons I was running. In the Senate, he'll work to make college affordable, fight for universal health care, and end the war in Iraq. Over pictures of students on a campus, a patient being treated by a friendly, super competent health care provider, and troops getting off a plane. Then we cut to a shot of me alongside Mrs. Moline in the classroom. Thanks, Mrs. Moline. You're welcome, Alan. I turned to camera with a delighted smile. I'm Al Lynn Franken, and I approve this message because I'm serious about fighting for Minnesota families. We ran the ad for a couple weeks right before the caucuses, and it was a huge hit. We started getting emails at the campaign from Mrs. Moline's former students and forwarded them on to her. Mrs. Moline would share some of them with me, and I will never forget one in particular. I read it to teachers all the time. Dear Mrs. Moline, you are my favorite teacher. I wasn't a very good student. I had a hard time with math, and your spelling tests were hard. But you saw that I liked art. And I remember you staying after school one day to paint a window with me. You made me feel special, parentheses, loved. Now I'm a teacher, too. I teach special ed kids. And I try every day to make them feel the way you made me feel. I just wanted to say thank you. On February 5th, 2008, Minnesotans gathered for their local caucuses. I spent the night running from caucus site to caucus site, giving the quickest stump speech I could to fire up the crowds. But they were pretty fired up even without my help. Barack Obama had brought new energy to the Democratic primary and new people to the process. Minnesota's previous record for caucus attendance was around 80,000. That year, we had 214,000. Best of all, the overwhelming majority of them were supporting me. The people who had been selected as delegates on caucus night would now go on to their county and Senate district conventions, where they would elect the delegates who would get to confer the party's endorsement for U.S. Senate at the state convention on June 7th in Rochester. And since all four DFL candidates had committed to abiding by the convention's endorsement, that was the ticket to taking on Coleman and the general. Everything was falling into place. We had passed our first test with flying colors. But as Minnesota journalist Doug Groh wrote on caucus night, I still had work to do. Interestingly, Franken was the most cautious in assessing the situation. Quoting me, "It sounds like we sent a lot of people to the district conventions." That's not exactly a snappy response, Franken was told. "Many a slip twixt cup and lip," he said. A reporter and a couple Franken supporters looked at the candidate blankly. "What'd you say?" "You guys never heard that," said Franken. He went slower for the reporter. "Many a slip twixt..." "Twixt?" the reporter asked. "Yes," said Franken. "Many a slip twixt cup and lip." "What does that mean?" I don't know who said it, said Franken. Google it, but it means a lot can go wrong between the start and finish. Chapter 15. Twixt Cup and Lip. On March 10th, 2008, the New York Times broke the news that the governor of New York, Eliot Spitzer, had been a client of a high-end escort service, spending thousands of dollars on prostitutes while serving as New York's attorney general and in his current position as chief executive of the Empire State. Watching the news in my tiny office at campaign headquarters in St. Paul, I was shocked and more than a little bummed out. I had really admired Spitzer, who had been a crusader for progressive reforms, taking on Wall Street banks and powerful corporations with an incomparable fearlessness, almost a swagger. I had even thought of him as a potential vice presidential candidate in 2008, or maybe someday the first Jewish president. Now all that was out the window. The more I thought about it, the more depressed I got. I thought about how hard he must have worked to win his first election, and how many people it helped, and how important it must have been to all of them that he get the chance to make a difference. I thought about all the important work he had done as attorney general and was doing now as governor, and what would happen to his mission of reining in corporate abuse. I thought about other politicians who had made similar mistakes, like Gary Hart, who, confronted with rumors that he was cheating on his wife, dared reporters to follow him. When the reporters did then follow him, they discovered that he was, in fact, cheating on his wife. Hart's behavior wasn't just self-destructive. It was bat-crap crazy. How could these guys risk everything that they'd worked for like that? How could they live with themselves after letting so many people down? While I was staring off in the middle distance, musing about the fallibility of man, a great cheer erupted out in the bullpen. Still lost in thought, I opened the door to my office. By now, our campaign had expanded. We had dozens of staff and interns, most of them shockingly young. Doing well, at some point I lost track of what everyone was doing, or indeed, who everyone was. And now they were all running around excitedly, high-fiving and fist-bumping and doing weird young people hugs, toasting each other with these horrible little five-hour energy shots that everyone seemed to be hooked on. It was like VE Day. "What's going on?" I asked, to no one in particular. Someone interrupted the revelry long enough to fill the candidate in. "Cerisi dropped out." "Oh," I said. It's not that this wasn't good news. I was now the presumptive nominee. But I was still stuck in my funk, distracted by the tragic fall of Eliot Spitzer. And I couldn't help but feel a strange sense of foreboding. No, I wasn't worried about getting caught patronizing high-end escorts, or, for that matter, escorts at any price point. The truth, however, was that Cerisi dropping out was kind of a mixed blessing. We'd been laser-focused on the convention in June, but now the general election was effectively underway, 3 months ahead of schedule. We were the dog that caught the car, and in retrospect, it's clear that we weren't ready for what was coming next. It started with a post on Michael Broadcorb's blog, Minnesota Democrats Exposed. Apparently, the company I had set up to handle the business side of my writing and public speaking, called Allen Franken Inc., or AFI for short, had had a $25,000 judgment filed against it in New York State for failing to carry workers' compensation and disability insurance from June 2002 to March 2005. This was news to me, and that was exactly the problem. When you run for office, you generally commission what's known as a self-research book, long before you launch your campaign. It's basically an investigation of yourself that reveals stuff like old workers' comp judgments so you can take care of them before they're sprung on you by hostile bloggers. We hired a firm to do that, but we should have hired them earlier. As it happened, they had recently discovered the workers' comp judgment during a public records search, but were waiting to tell us about it until they had finished looking into it, which I guess would have been a thoughtful gesture had it turned out to be nothing worth worrying about. In any event, it was embarrassing not to be able to explain how the screw-up had occurred, but it wasn't a fatal blow. We continued slowly gaining on Coleman in the polls, and even Harry and Chuck were gradually thawing. Meanwhile, however, Republicans were digging into AFI's activities in the state of California, where we had briefly registered the company while I was working on Late Line, a short-lived sitcom I had done for NBC. Soon, Michael Broadcorp had another scoop. AFI hadn't terminated the registration correctly, and when it had stopped paying the small annual franchise fee, the registration was forfeited, which sounds bad. And it was embarrassing to get caught off guard again, but it was easy enough to explain. My accountant had simply sent in the wrong form to notify the state that I was no longer doing business there. Republicans, however, had something else up their sleeve. They pointed to news reports about speeches I had given in California and suggested that since I hadn't been paying the franchise fee, perhaps I'd dodge paying taxes on the income I'd earned there as well. Franny and I knew that was ridiculous. We pay our taxes every year, but we realized that we had paid taxes on the income from those speeches to the state we were living in until 2006, New York, and not to the states where I'd done the speeches. In other words, the good news was that I hadn't committed the unpardonable sin of evading taxes. The bad news was that I had committed the relatively understandable but harder to explain mistake of paying those taxes to the wrong place. And the worst news was that we were on the defense yet again. It took us a long, horrible weekend to reconstruct years of back taxes. We sent $70,000 in checks to 17 very confused states that didn't generally get sent money they hadn't asked for, and requested corresponding refunds from New York, where we had overpaid our taxes by almost exactly the same amount. And I spent an entire day explaining what happened in a series of agonizing interviews. It was not my favorite day of the campaign, but it felt good to be able to lay it all out there, and after a week of brutal press, the stories were less awful than we feared. It was an honest mistake, and when we learned about it, we fixed it. People could understand that. Especially people who were suddenly realizing they'd made the same mistake themselves. For example, presented with an opportunity to beat me up on the Fox News morning show Fox and Friends, Newt Gingrich gave me a pass. Watching it, I realized, I bet Newt doesn't pay taxes to the right states for his speeches either. We lived to fight another day. And I was proud how I'd handle the crisis. I'd always known that sometimes people are judged more by how they deal with the mistake than by the mistake itself. At the beginning of the campaign, I'd even considered deliberately making a mistake so I could be seen as handling it well, and as it turned out, I didn't need to. Still, Coleman was now up by 7 points in the polls, and as we'd gotten sidetracked by workers' comp and taxes, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, the peace candidate, had begun to gain some traction in an endorsement race that most people had assumed was over. But we felt like we were okay in large part because we finally managed to land a campaign manager. I'd known Stephanie Shriok for a few years, since she had been the finance director for Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign, where she had revolutionized grassroots small-dollar fundraising. I had actually tried to hire her to do the same job for Midwest Values PAC back in 2005. She passed, choosing instead to manage John Tester's successful 2006 Senate campaign in her home state of Montana. But she and I had really hit it off, and we knew she had ties to Minnesota. Her grandmother lived here, and she'd gone to college in Mankato. As we gained momentum in the early spring, Chuck Schumer had grown more willing to help us out. And as we'd lost momentum in the late spring, he realized that the best way to help us out was to convince Stephanie to come back to Minnesota to manage my race. She finally agreed to come on board, promising that she'd arrive in Minnesota the week before the June 7th convention. And despite everything, we still felt like things were more or less on track, with the endorsement still mine to lose and Coleman within reach. And then... Chapter 16, Public Opprobrium. The January 2000 issue of Playboy magazine was its millennial issue, and they had asked important writers like William F. Buckley, father of American conservatism, and prolific science fiction author Isaac Asimov, to pen thoughtful articles pegged to the turning of the millennium. They also asked me to write something funny. Since it was Playboy, I thought I'd write a parody of a Playboy article, specifically the kind of feature they always used to have about some hip new technology that every hip guy should be hip to. You know, like hi-fis, jet skis, or in this case, since we were talking about the future, virtual sex. Funny idea, right? So I wrote about my visit to a citadel of higher learning, the Minnesota Institute of Titology. As you may have guessed from its name, the institute was fictitious, as were all the activities depicted in the piece, which devolved into a lengthy and vivid description of my participation in various virtual sex acts. I had given the piece the unfortunate title of Pornorama, proving that, as of late 1999, I hadn't been planning a run for political office. Cut to May 19th, 2008, 3 weeks before the DFL convention. Republicans were trying to make hay over a fundraiser I'd held in Chicago with Chrissy Hefner, the progressive activist and daughter of Playboy founder Hugh Hefner, and to call further attention to my unsavory association with the Hefner dynasty, Michael Broadcorp published the text of Pornorama on Minnesota Democrats Exposed. You gotta hand it to the guy, and actually that's exactly how it worked. Republican researchers did the actual legwork on this fantastic oppo and just handed it to Broadcorp, who would dutifully write it up on his blog. Once again, it came as a surprise to our team, although this time it was because the research firm we'd hired had only looked for articles listed as being written by Al Franken, and this one was listed in the Nexus database under the byline Franken Al. A stricken Jess McIntosh walked into my office where Chris Dahl was cracking the whip on another endless call time session. Al, do you remember writing an article for Playboy where you talked about having sex with robots? Oh, yeah. It was kind of funny. Have you read it? Yes. Uh-huh. Did you think it was funny? Jess turned to Chris. Can we have the room? Republicans, as you might expect, did their best to turn Pornorama into a big story. A group of GOP women legislators wrote an open letter attacking me for demeaning and degrading women. I know this seems quaint, but back in 2008, Republicans did not consider demeaning and degrading women senatorial, let alone presidential. Meanwhile, we got a stern email from an Eric White of a company called VR Innovations. Subject, trademark use. Please advise Al, the term virtual sex machine is a trademark of VR Innovations / Eric J. White, and was in 2000 when he wrote the article for Playboy. Reference USPTO.gov. We chose not to pursue the matter then, but will not tolerate confusion with our trademark today as some sort of political attention getter. If he chooses to use that term in his upcoming speeches, please be sure it is in reference to our products and services. Thank you. But a trademark infringement lawsuit was the least of my concerns. As Hurricane Pornorama gained momentum, I began to feel slightly beleaguered and a little sorry for myself, so I emailed my friend Al Gore asking for a little advice. I would love to discuss with you sometime personal coping mechanisms for being a politician who is being unfairly attacked. I'm doing well, but I'm finding there are aspects of running for office that are unpleasant. Gore wrote back, "Suck it up." "Suck it up" became a mantra of sorts. I wrote it on a piece of paper and tacked it up to the wall in my office at headquarters, where I would spend hours calling delegates and other politicos, trying to explain myself, asking them not to bail on me. Truly, there would be much for me to suck up in the days that followed. Hurricane Pornorama made landfall on May 29th, 9 days before the convention, when Representative Betty McCollum, a DFLer who represents St. Paul, finally broke the dam by telling the Associated Press that my pornographic writings were indefensible. Republicans attacking me for something I'd written was one thing. A prominent DFLer doing it made the story exponentially more damaging. That afternoon, Politico reported that all five members of the DFL congressional delegation had met to share their concerns about what my baggage might mean for their chances down the ballot. Even Tim Walz, the freshman congressman for whom I had campaigned tirelessly in 2006 and who is one of my best friends in Minnesota politics, couldn't help but speak up, telling the AP that the piece was pretty inappropriate and suggesting that he might not want to share a ticket with me. I'm concerned that from the top of the party all the way down, people make a simple assumption that there are commonalities if we're all in the same party. I don't want to get associations made that I can't control. This was officially a crisis. I felt terrible. On the one hand, I felt like if I could just sit down with everyone who read Franken Wright's sex article for Playboy, I could rescue the piece from the gears of the dehumorizer and explain why I'd written it. On the other hand, it seemed like people didn't really care whether there was a good explanation. There was no rehumorizing this one. Even in context, the fact that I had written it at all freaked some people out. Still, when I talked to Chuck Schumer the next day and he suggested that I consider apologizing for writing the piece, I balked. What would I even be apologizing for writing a silly humor piece? That was my job for 35 years. It felt wrong, no worse. It felt like a betrayal of myself. To renounce one particular piece just because people felt it crossed the line. Once you even acknowledge that there is a line, that there are things you shouldn't be allowed to joke about, that there are words that can't be said no matter what the context, you're selling out the very idea of comedy. Stephanie Shriok's first day in the office was June 2nd, and she walked into a building on fire. Frankly, we were relieved she showed up at all. When the Playboy article surfaced, Stephanie had been in Washington. She'd read it and taken it to Jim Messina, a Montana buddy of hers and the man who had managed President Obama's 2012 campaign. "Is this a campaign killer?" she asked him. Messina scanned it. "No," he said. "He can survive this." But Shriok noticed he was blushing. And then that day, Republicans had held another press conference to denounce a whole new list of old jokes that fit under the umbrella of offensive to women. 22-year-old Natalie Volin had the unenviable job of managing our outreach to a progressive feminist community that was deeply divided about all of this. When she would tell me that I needed to call one of her people right away, I'd jump to do it. Though sometimes she would decide that the call should come from someone, anyone, other than me. Natalie did heroic work building and maintaining and in some cases rehabilitating those relationships. But if I was going to get past this, I myself was going to have to find a way to address and allay people's fears and concerns, whether they were judgmental, anyone who writes something like this has no business being a senator, or strategic. Republicans are going to eat him alive. Because with the convention just days away, our numbers were beginning to drop. James Knightley reports on delegate calls grew less confident and more troubling. And some of the superdelegates who had been on his whiteboard for months as supporters were starting to waver. On Tuesday, June 3rd, 4 days out, a field organizer from the 8th Congressional District, Duluth and the Iron Range, reported in with an SOS. Subject, help. Bleeding delegates. The top loser is Mary B., 9% last night in the first. I am losing them in the 8th. I think my strongs are below 50% now. The 7th Congressional is the same. The phones are saturated. They aren't answering. It's impossible to connect with these people. Emails, most are older women who don't use email. It's 3 days out. We can't mail them something. If you get them, you spend the first 10 minutes getting chewed out for harassing them too much. We need to reach them. Al and his child porn stuff is killing me. No, I'm proud to say that I've never written any child porn, but I wasn't going to quibble. This is bigger than tax issues. I don't want to seem sensational. Sorry. What could I do? What could I say to these folks that would restore their rapidly dwindling faith in me? The team and I were spending hours on the phone calling delegates. James divvying up the names and numbers, based on his calculation of what they needed to hear and who they needed to hear it from. And as we all, me, Franny, Thomason, the staff, everyone, hit the phones that night, more and more strong Frankens were turning to lean Frankens. More and more lean Frankens were turning to undecideds. And more undecideds weren't returning our calls. Forget about winning in November. It began to seem possible, very possible, that my campaign wouldn't even survive the DFL convention. Then, and probably, things got worse. The next day, June 5th, the Thursday before the Saturday convention, Republicans accused me of joking about rape. During the 1994-95 season of SNL, a New York Magazine writer spent the week at the show. Lauren had given the writer full access to everything, and the resulting article entitled "Comedy Isn't Funny" was kind of a hit piece on the show and on Lauren himself. That happens. My, quote, joke about rape, unquote, came during a 2 a.m. rewrite session where we were working on an Andy Rooney piece that Norm MacDonald had written for himself. Norm's take on Andy Rooney, the extremely popular, long-standing humorist for 60 Minutes, was that his humor could be a little on the banal side. In his sketch, Norm played Rooney cleaning out his desk. Here's a letter from California. Here's one from Illinois. Here's another one from California. Here's one from Maryland. This one's from California, too. Here's another one from California. There must be a lot of people who live in California. All of us around the table were looking for a turn in the piece, and I suggested that we suddenly transform Rooney into a monster after he finds an empty bottle of sedatives in another drawer. I give the pills to Leslie Stahl, then when Leslie's passed out, I take her to the closet and rape her. Understand that I was not intending for this extremely dark joke to be aired on American television. I was just suggesting a direction for the turn. I was like a NASA engineer who designed a hydraulic pump for the Mars rover that provided the breakthrough that led to the final hydraulic pump on the Mars rover. We eventually settled on Rooney saying he had spiked Mike Wallace's drink and photographed him nude in a variety of positions. There was a reason Republicans saved this one for last. It had the feel of a knockout blow. Joking about rape? What the hell? The thing of it was, I could answer that question. Here's what the hell. SNL had developed a culture which prized, no, celebrated dark humor. The best example I can think of took place at a party at Lorraine Newman's house in L.A. Billy Murray carried Gilda Radner around the room after her second series of chemotherapy, saying, "Say your goodbyes now, everyone. She's a goner." Gilda was laughing hysterically. That isn't an excuse necessarily, but it is an explanation. When I discussed the situation with Conan O'Brien, who had been an SNL writer with me from 1989 to 1990, he wondered how I could ever explain the culture of a comedy rewrite table at 2 a.m. "If I was on the stand at a trial," Conan said, "and the prosecutor asked me, 'Mr. O'Brien, have you ever joked at a rewrite table about defiling Lincoln's body immediately after he was shot?' I'd have to throw myself on the mercy of the court." I knew exactly how a person who wasn't completely ignorant of the horror of sexual assault could end up saying something in a writer's room that made it sound like he was, but I didn't know how to explain it to Minnesotans. Frankly, I didn't know if they'd even let me. So that was my day on Thursday, the day before delegates would start arriving in Rochester for Saturday morning's convention. Late that afternoon, with the newspapers asking for what felt like a really important comment from me on the Leslie Stahl story, my staff and consultants were in crisis mode on a long and unpleasant email thread that, fortunately for my own sanity, did not include me. If you've ever wondered how campaigns make decisions in crisis situations, perhaps you'll enjoy hearing it as much as I don't enjoy reading it. I'm not going to tell you which consultant said what, because this was basically the same kind of thing as the writer's room that produced the Leslie Stahl joke, people workshopping ideas with no expectation that they'd ever be made public. One of my consultants offered this pitch at 5:40 p.m. I understand that some people have seen my satiric writings as representing my views about women in real life. That is not true. I respect women. I've been married for 32 years, and Franny and I are proud of our children, including our daughter Thomason, who is a teacher. I respect women in the home and in the workplace. Jess piped up. Could we hit Norm at the end? She added, and I will work to represent them in the U.S. Senate, something that Norm Coleman has been doing a very bad job of. Another consultant. The line about their kids sounds very odd. She pitched, I understand that some people have seen my writings as representing my views in real life. They don't. They are satire. Some of it not very funny. In real life, I've been married for 32 years, have two wonderful children, and respect women in the home and the workplace. Wait, replied Jess. What about the pivot to Norm? By now it was 7:20, and the DSCC's guy on the email chain was concerned. I don't think the pivot is as important. But we could wordsmith this to death over the next hour. You gotta get something to the AP so they can move a rewrite. Shriok chimed in. This seems to have gotten weaker. And read it out loud and it sounds arrogant or at least defensive. At 7:26, a new draft. I understand that some people have seen my writings as representing my views in real life. They don't. In real life, I've been married for 32 years, and Franny and I are proud of our children. I respect women in the home and in the workplace, and I will work to represent them in the U.S. Senate, something that Norm Coleman hasn't been doing for the last 6 years. 7:30, the DSCC. Go! 7:31, yet another consultant. I suggest adding the kid's name so that it is at least obvious one is a daughter. A few minutes later, the team decided to come to me for final approval of this quote. I understand that some people have seen my satirical writings as representing my views in real life. They don't. In real life, I've been married to my wife, Franny, for 32 years and have two wonderful children, a daughter and a son. I have always respected women in the home and the workplace, and I will work to represent them in the U.S. Senate, something that Norm Coleman hasn't been doing for the last 6 years. At 7:39, Andy returned to the email thread with bad news. Al hates it. He relayed this suggestion from me. I'm proud of my career as a satirist, which doesn't mean every joke I've ever told was funny or indeed appropriate. In real life, though, I've been married for 32 years. Franny and I are proud of our son and daughter. I respect women both at home and in the workplace, and I will work incredibly hard to represent them in the Senate, something Norm Coleman hasn't been doing for the last 6 years. A minute later, one of the consultants offered, I understand why he wants to say he's proud of his career as a satirist, but keep in mind, there is a large segment of the electorate for whom the only aspects of that career they will know about are the rape and Playboy aspects. That introductory language strikes me as satisfying for Al, but dangerous with older women, voters who know the least about Al's career and those most likely to be offended. And another consultant, getting directly to the point, Andy, does he hate us strategically or personally? I think we are in real trouble here and need to say something that affirms Al's respect for women. We are about to miss the opportunity to do so pre-convention. 15 minutes passed. We heard from the consultants, from the DSCC, and eventually I signed off on this, with the word regret as suggested by Chuck Schumer himself. I'm proud of my career as a satirist, which doesn't mean every joke I've ever told was funny, and I regret that some of them have caused offense. In real life, though, I've been married for 32 years. Franny and I are proud of our son and daughter. I respect women, both at home and in the workplace, and I will work incredibly hard to represent them in the Senate, something Norm Coleman hasn't been doing for the last 6 years. At 7:56, two consultants weighed in simultaneously. One said, almost all of us have caused offense. He really doesn't regret it, except now. This is a dangerous half-apology. If we do it, it's because we need to save ourselves now, but we will be dealing with which writings cause regret for a very long time. The other, send it. Finally, after several more phone calls, and with reporters' deadlines approaching, or perhaps past, as it was well after 8 p.m., we settled on this. I'm proud of my career as a satirist, which doesn't mean every joke I've ever told was funny or, indeed, appropriate. I understand and regret that people have been legitimately offended by some of the things I've written. In real life, though, I've been married for 32 years. Franny and I are proud of our son and daughter. I respect women in both my personal and professional life, and I will work incredibly hard to represent them in the Senate, something Norm Coleman hasn't been doing for the last 6 years. Jess sent it around, writing, "Floor is open for 5 minutes. Call if you think this will end the campaign." DFL convention begins with Franken fending off criticism, read the Star Tribune headline the morning of Friday, June 6th, as delegates began to arrive in Rochester. The story included our heavily workshopped statement and also a quote from Norm Coleman, who was clearly enjoying the whole situation. While Al Franken was joking about raping women and a host of other degrading and humiliating jokes throughout his career, I was in the Minnesota Attorney General's office working to throw rapists behind bars. I was in the mayor's office working with advocates for battered women. But I didn't have time to worry about him. I had my hands full with the convention. Everyone wanted me to do something to reassure delegates, but it wasn't clear what that something was. I felt worse than ever. I felt like people whose respect meant a lot to me had begun to feel like I was a terrible person. I thought about Elliot Spitzer again and about all the people he had let down because he couldn't stop his own flaws from sabotaging his desire to do good. I thought about Paul Wellstone and I wondered if I was letting him down, not to mention all the people who had trusted me to carry on his legacy, or at least win back his seat. On the way down to Rochester, I got a call. Shriok. "Forget about whatever anybody has told you," she said. "What do you think about this?" I sighed miserably. "I feel bad that people feel bad about this, and I want to apologize for that." "Then that's what we're going to do," she said. I spent the afternoon and evening working delegates, and that night, Shriok, Andy, and I stayed up late, working on the closing argument speech I'd give immediately before the delegates voted. It felt like the whole campaign was coming down to what I'd say on that stage. I felt inadequate, guilty, confused, unworthy. But I didn't have time for a dark night of the soul. I had about an hour, maybe two if I had one of those energy drinks. I had to suck it up. I had to stop feeling sorry for myself. I had to pull myself out of the shame spiral and confront this head on. All campaign long, I'd avoided apologizing for things I had written or said, because it felt like doing so would mean apologizing for everything I had done over 40 years in comedy, ever since Tom and I were performing at Chapel back at Blake. To say I was sorry for writing a joke was to sell out my career, to sell out who I had been my entire life. And I wasn't sorry that I had written Pornorama or pitched that stupid Leslie Stahl joke at 2 a.m. I was just doing my job. But running for office is a different job. When you run for office, you're asking people to stand with you and work for you and believe in you. And you're making a promise that it'll be worth it. People had to know I understood that. It was nearly 2 a.m. when Andy hit send on the final draft, after which he had to start writing 2 more speeches. A victory speech that I would deliver after I had won the endorsement, and a concession that I would deliver if I lost it. Saturday, endorsement day. I took the stage to what I can only describe as nervously enthusiastic applause. "I'm Al Franken," I began, "and I'm going to beat Norm Coleman." I talked about a few of the people I met along the way who were there in the room as delegates. Sitting with the Blue Earth County delegation was Casey Carmody, the MSU Mankato student who had told me he sold his blood plasma to pay for tuition. Among the tiny delegation from Kennebec County was Kathy Kowalik, a nurse who had told me she saw elderly patients rush into her intensive care unit because they couldn't afford their medications. And there from Anoka County was Sergeant Sam Scott, whom I'd met on a USO tour in Iraq in 2006. "Many of the men and women he served with are still there," I told the crowd. "Some aren't coming home." I took a deep breath. "That's why I'm doing this, for Casey, for Kathy, for Sam, for the people of Minnesota. That's who I want to work for. And that's what this election is about. Another deep breath. That's not exactly what this past week has been about, I continued. I've had some tough conversations this week. The tension in the room was incredible. The delegates didn't know what was coming, but they knew that whatever it was, whatever they'd been waiting for, whatever they staked their hopes on, it was coming right now. It kills me. The things I said and wrote sent a message to some of my friends in this room and people in this state that they can't count on me to be a champion for women, a champion for all Minnesotans in this campaign and in the Senate. And then, I'm sorry for that. Sitting up in the rafters where she could observe the crowd, Stephanie Shriok said there was the briefest moment of absolute silence, and then she heard the collective exhale of some 1,300 delegates. And then they stood and cheered. It was the first time I'd ever gotten a standing ovation based entirely on a crowd's overwhelming sense of relief. The applause drowned out the next line, but I kept going. Because that's not who I am. I'm a husband, married to my favorite person on earth, Franny, for 32 years. I'm a father of a son and daughter who we taught to respect everyone and who we're incredibly proud of. And for 35 years, I was a writer. I wrote a lot of jokes. Some of them weren't funny. Some of them were inappropriate. Some of them were downright offensive. I understand that. And I understand that the people of Minnesota deserve a senator who won't say things that make them uncomfortable. But I'm in this race because there are some people in Washington who could afford to feel a little less comfortable. And that's what I'm going to do. Now I had the audience behind me. Now I could have some fun. I lit into the oil companies and the drug companies and the insurance companies. I declared that it was time to stop waiting for health care reform and get it done. And I promised that the first person I was going to make a little uncomfortable was Norm Coleman. It was in the delegates' hands now, but we could sense that something had changed for the better. A weight had been lifted. As the first ballots were counted, it was clear that I had surpassed the 60% I needed to win, although not by much. Jack Nelson Pallmeyer graciously offered to have the convention endorse me by acclamation so that no one would need to know how close it had been. I never had to look at Andy's draft of a concession speech, which is good because, exhausted and bitter, he had larded it with profanity. It wasn't just that I had survived the convention, although survived was almost certainly the correct verb. As Shriok later told me, it wasn't just what you said, it was the way you said it. I think the delegates realized we get the candidate we want. They understood how badly I wanted to win, how passionate I was about doing good, as Paul would say, about improving people's lives. Having won them over in the most excruciating manner imaginable, they were with me for good. Shriok says we never had a base problem after that, never had to worry about finding people to volunteer, to knock on doors, to make phone calls. That night I went to bed early. Shriok took the team out to get steaks and cocktails. Everyone was exhausted, barely coherent, their kidneys damaged irreparably by energy drinks. "Oh my God," Jess moaned. "Food. Actual food. On plates." Meanwhile, Andy was falling asleep in a bowl of mashed potatoes. And then, the next morning, we all went back to the Twin Cities and got back to work. Election Day was 149 days away. Chapter 17, My First Powwow. When I first started running, I was almost completely ignorant about Indian country. But we have 11 reservations in Minnesota, and I knew enough to know that tribes in our state and all around the country face enormous problems. These problems can seem so big and so numerous that people in a position to do something about them often give up. Not Paul Wellstone. Paul had been the last Minnesota senator to serve on the Indian Affairs Committee. In that tradition, I wanted our tribes to be well represented in the Senate. 2 days after I announced my candidacy, I visited the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, or Ojibwe, in northeastern Minnesota. Karen Diver, Fond du Lac's no-nonsense but affable chairwoman, was puzzled that I'd come up to meet them so early in the campaign, instead of waiting to check that box in the last couple weeks before the election, as almost every candidate does. I said I wanted to learn about Indians. Karen began by talking about sovereignty. The Constitution recognizes Indian tribes as sovereign nations. Now, you'll be shocked to hear this, but there's no way to sugarcoat it. Historically, the United States has not always respected tribal sovereignty. Karen told me about a recent study on sovereignty by Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, which concluded that tribes who govern themselves do better than those dictated to by the federal government. I found the study online and called Karen a few days later to discuss it. She was surprised I'd actually gone home and read it. So one of the first things I learned about Indians is that they don't expect much from politicians. During the campaign, I visited most of our reservations.